Okay, you can start.
Is Colin close enough to the mic? Yeah.
Testing.
All right. Fine. Griffith oral history recording interview with Mr. Colin Phillips, curator of grounds. Mr. Phillips, I believe your association with Griffith goes back 21 years. That would be about to 1972. You must be one of this young university's oldest inhabitants. What were the circumstances of your first contact with Griffith?
Well, I just answered an ad in the paper. They were looking for a curator of grounds.
Oh.
And I was working for Department of Air at the time. And
Department of
Air.
Oh, yeah.
And I wasn't very happy about one or two things, and I warned them that if something better came up, then I'd be looking for it. And I'd travelled past the campus for years and known that it was going to be a campus, and sort of, I guess I had a premonition that that was going to be my future. So when the ad popped up, I was quite confident.
Isn't that interesting?
Yes.
Travelling past it for years, what did it look like in those days?
Well, it was just some iron gates across the roadway. The roadway was built in 1966 for the extensions of what was then Queensland University, but then they decided apparently to spend more money out on the other campus, and this one was put on hold for a while.
Ah, I see.
So there's just these.
So there were iron gates in front of the
where the
roadway was.
Yeah, so the road came right down to Kessels Road.
I see. And did you ever walk over the campus in those days?
No.
Uh-huh. And the position you were offered was
curator.
So yes, that was what they advertised for.
Yes.
Now, what was your background?
Well, very interesting. I came from England as a child, born and bred in a glass house and spent some time in an air raid shelter. But my father was always involved in landscaping, floristry, floral work and things like that. So it just ran in the family.
Mm.
And in fact, they used to buy me bags of cement when I was a boy because that was my hobby, building fish ponds and gardens. And, they'd let me take over completely the family garden at the time.
Whereabouts in England were you?
Croxley Green, which was near Watford.
Oh, yes.
But we lived in Wynnum for a long time, and then we had a nursery at Capella Bar. So I've always been into plants and landscaping, really.
Uh-huh. And then what was your first job?
Well, my mother actually didn't want me in this. She wanted me into a trade. So I worked in all sorts of places for the first year, including for White Houses as an apprentice piano tuner and an electrician for Sunbeam Electric. But all the time in the back of it, the plants were pulling, and eventually that's what won.
Oh, that's a very interesting background. I believe you now live on the campus in the curator's cottage. When was the cottage established?
In fact, the curator's residence and the squash courts were the first buildings that were completed.
That's where it is.
So I moved into the curator's residence with my wife and two children, the 21st of May 73, and that was in fact the same day as the then site and buildings moved into the squash courts. So that everything started from there. Well, in fact, not the squash courts, but in fact what is now the gymnasium. And the squash courts were then used as the council chambers.
Really?
Yes.
Goodness.
So
Sighton Buildings was in the gymnasium,
yes.
The now gymnasium.
Yes.
And council chamber in the squash courts.
Squash courts.
First time.
And of course, it's quite interesting because I don't know whether you know much about squash courts, but squash courts have another famous claim to history, and the first nuclear pile was actually built in some squash courts.
Really?
So it was a very reactive start, I suppose.
Well, I've played squash, but I didn't know that they had that background. Who were the people with whom you worked in the beginning?
Well, Neil Thayer, of course, and he's still part of our division.
Mm.
Roger Johnston, the then site planner, who in fact was there every day until the appointment of the then site and buildings manager, which was Alan Cole. And I saw both of those people as very important on the physical development of the site. One has an artistic touch and one was a really practical man.
Mm. You talked of the road. Did the ring road exist at that
Yes, the major part of the Ring Road and what is now Kessel's Entrance have existed since 1966. And in fact, the oval was roughly cut too, and stockpiles. And the map, there are still maps and aerial photographs in existence that testify to that.
Oh, that's very interesting. I hadn't realised that. What was your actual role? Were the job specifications laid down?
Oh, yes, but they were pretty loose. And in fact, in those early days, I did everything from hanging up toilet rolls to fire extinguishers and repairing the roads. I was it. But eventually our division specialised, and I was even security, because we were the only people living on site.
Ah, yes, I see.
So I was actually everything to start with. But, of course, as the years went by, I got more and more specialised. Yeah. As more and more people were appointed. And in fact, to start with, there wasn't any landscape staff. That was part of my job, was actually to get tools and equipment and recruit people. Yes, And that wasn't too easy. We had a lot of trouble even getting people. In fact, out of sheer desperation, we wrote a sign up and nailed it up on a tree out the front of the campus to get our first gardener.
Really?
Yes, and indeed he was one of the best we ever had. But so things have changed now.
What was his name?
That was Jack Hampson.
Jack Hampson.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. And he's a famous man in this part of the world. His parents had a big property up the road with a big shop there now. And they, you know, he was a man that had always been self-employed and therefore self-motivated.
Ah, yes.
And in fact, in our business, that's what you need.
Yes.
Really. Mm. Landscape gardening is a bit like housework. It's a thousand decisions an hour and you've got to make them.
Yes. Yes, I can imagine. You obviously have a rapport with your wife then.
Yes, well, we do. We're the best of friends. We're friends and lovers. And you know, I just wish everyone else in the world enjoyed the same relationship as we do.
Marvellous.
Yeah.
You worked with the original site planner, Roger Johnson. What sort of a man was Roger Johnson? He came from Sydney, didn't he, or did he go to Sydney eventually?
Well, I think he was originally English.
Ah, yes.
I have the same regrets about Professor Willett as I actually had about Roger Johnston, and that was that I didn't actually argue and discuss and debate as much as other people have since made it clear to me that was permissible.
I see.
And so as such, perhaps, it wasn't that I was essentially over-obedient, but I didn't really explore their philosophies as in-depth as history showed that I could have without getting into trouble.
Yes. Oh, what a pity.
Yes. But I suspected always that he was a man of fairly strong opinions and well-founded opinions. But then again, in retrospect, I think that if you could reason well enough with him, you could actually talk him around.
This is Johnson.
Well, both of them for that matter. Uh-huh. Both of them for that matter. Yes, yes. Mm. In those days, most of the people that were appointed here, I felt, essentially had to have strong opinions. They weren't me tours. They were pioneers. They were visionaries.
Mm.
And that's what the university got, and that's what it needed. And I think, in fact, things have changed a bit now. I think the bureaucrats and the money people are now in the ascendancy, and the university has lost some of its way on account of that. But that's only my opinion. I could be wrong.
Mm. Yes, well, with growth, things happen, and there are political changes that cause things to happen, and who knows, you know, where it actually begins. How many staff did you have? You had no staff to start off with, and then you...
Inched up.
Yes.
Yeah, inched up over the years. Mm. I've always advocated that we needed an extra staff person for each building. But, of course, we need people here, even if there aren't any buildings, because just to manage the forest itself, there's a requirement.
Yes.
But politically, I always thought we could justify one extra person for each building, but we never, ever got that, of course.
No.
And, of course, the philosophy has always been to reinstate, as far as possible and practical, the natural scenery using plants that are endemic to the site, so that although the initial construction and reconstruction costs have been very high, our maintenance costs are about the lowest of any university in Australia.
Maintenance costs are the lowest?
Yes, for the landscaping.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because once you've got the bushland there, all you have to do is reap the praise and the firewood and do some control burns.
Yes.
You know, so except for the mess that students make and the general thing of people living here.
Yeah.
They are essentially low maintenance landscapes.
Oh, that's marvellous, isn't it? What are the biggest problems that you faced in the care of the site?
Well, I guess if I'd known in the beginning how daunting it was, I probably wouldn't have written for the job.
don't believe that.
I don't think I had as many problems in the early days as I actually have now.
Yeah.
And I think there's two reasons for that. I think the fact is that the landscape isn't so appreciated by the people in command as it was in those days. I think the emphasis has been more towards, you know, getting students on seats and things like that, the more down-to-earth things. And, I think the Philistines are amongst us a lot more than they were in those days.
Mm.
Secondly, I think the mere fact that we have so many students here brings about its own special problems. For instance, the only places where we suffer lots of plant diseases are along the verges and along the corridors where people walk and vehicles drive. Because here the birds are driven away and they can't do their job of keeping things under control. So just the sheer numbers of people here, the pressures on the site, it didn't really matter if one person walked across the lawn.
No.
But now if everybody walks across the shortest path, then it's just a mud track. Mm. So, you know, managing the movements of people are making more problems than we ever had before.
And can you do that? Can you manage
that? Oh, yes, but you have to be mean. Well, basically by design, by secret fences amongst the landscapes to stop people making shortcuts. And some places you may think, and when you walk around, those branches look very ugly laying on the ground there, but they are actually put there to dissuade people from making a shortcut.
Ah, oh, I see.
So we do it by stealth.
That's very good. Are you involved at all with the Tui Forest Protection Society?
Well, I don't have any direct contact, no. But that's not through lack of desire. It's just that I'm totally swallowed up. My whole life is swallowed up with many, many interests. Even outside this, I'm a member of many other organisations.
Are you?
Ah. Yes.
Hmm. And it was actually, this site was actually virgin forest, apart from the ring road, when you...
Yes and no. It's true that not much activity had happened here in the past, but that was mostly because most of the soil was very impoverished. There's some evidence down where I live of there being ploughed fields, like someone did do some cropping. There were some strawberry farms over on the western edge of the campus, and the Americans during the war used it a lot as a training base, and that's why there's so many tracks and eroded tracks, not only through our campus but through Tui Forest. So the place was far from clean, and in fact I think we shifted something like 5 or 6 trailer loads of car bodies out of here when I first came here.
Really?
And it wasn't unusual to have...
They were just dumped.
Dumped. And it wasn't unusual to have people knocking on the door saying, you know, where is the bike race? Because, you know, in those days it was a real place for motorcycles. And they drove us crazy. And it wasn't until we did patrols with cameras in the hand that we managed, and used the media, that we managed to frighten them away. But otherwise they had done a lot of damage here. So, no, it was far from perfect.
And how long did that go on?
Well, as the university got more serious and more people got here, I'd say within 5 or 6 years, we'd mostly got most of the bikes out of the site.
Hmm. Goodness. Did you have a policy of rehabilitation of the environment immediately after the completion of the buildings? And which was the first building that went up?
Right, well, I came here, there was the two buildings completed that I've already mentioned, and Science 1 and the Library and Humanities and University House were under construction,
mm-hmm.
and the Spine Walkway.
Mm-hmm.
This didn't give me very much to play with because quite a lot of damage had been done around those sites, and we didn't have the opportunity to salvage plants, which we endeavour to do now. So if we get sufficient warning... we salvage plants from the sites and then bring them back afterwards.
I see.
So we started off with a little bit behind the eight ball.
But you immediately wanted to rehabilitate.
Oh, well, that was the university's policy, which in a sense was laid down by a Brisbane architect called Mr. Birrell. He had done a preliminary inspection of the site and recommended that this be the way to go. And I couldn't help but endorse it, especially once I examined how poor the soil was.
Why would the soil be so poor? Because... you know, with all of the... Is it because of forest land? Is forest land always necessarily poor soil?
Well, it's dry sclerophyll forest and it's hilly, so the water was running off very quickly. And with lots of fires, that meant it kept impoverishing it. So, sure, in some of the lower ravines, there's plenty of soil, but most of the site is pretty dry and poor.
I see, and the topsoil will be washed
down,
off by the...
Yes, and rocky. If you dig down, you find, in fact, there's not so much rock. So over the millions of years, what happens is, as it erodes, then the rocks don't erode and they end up getting thicker and thicker near the top. So you end up sort of with a tile surface of boulders.
I see. who was it? Grass trees were all over. The xantharia or grass trees or black boys, whatever you like to call them, can't call them black boys now, were all over the site, weren't they? And it always used to be said that it was impossible to transplant them. You know, if you knocked them down, that was that. You couldn't. Were you the person who...
Well, I don't read those books. I don't read books that say you can't.
I see.
Oh, my understanding of plant tissue is simply that you can grow anything from a cutting, but your rate may not be very, very great. It may not be practical. So I said, well, let's give it a go. So we have. I have some regrets about that.
About what?
About actually doing it. Because... they really do much better if they're not disturbed. Yes. And although the transplant is often successful in the short term, it's often not so successful in the long term.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we actually have some now that are suffering and some that are dying because of the drought. They really haven't re-established themselves as well as they might if they'd always been in one spot.
I see.
They like the ground to be really tough and hard, and the movement loosens them up a bit. The other thing is that people now have an expectation that I can just pick the scenery up and put it down somewhere else. That's very difficult and very expensive, and sometimes I really think the scenery would be best left alone. And also other people outside the campus have noticed what we've been doing, and they've been plundering bushlands and putting them in pots and selling them. So there's two different attitudes.
Yes.
I've attempted to have a salvage mentality, but unfortunately other people have a financial mentality.
Yes.
So it's not without some long-term regrets.
No. Well, how did you actually manage to move them?
Well, the first ones, we didn't have any machinery, so I just did like they did in medieval times, just dug a square trench around them and then drove rods in underneath and then just pulled them out that way.
With as much soil as possible
yes,
adhering to
yes,
it.
Yes.
And then you already had a reception area
for them?
For them,
yes.
I see.
Yeah, yeah.
And did the first ones...
Yes, they did quite well. Yeah. But they don't exist there anymore because the building went up on that side.
So they had to be moved again?
Yeah, well, they generally don't cope with the second move very well. That's too much. No. I have hoped, actually, that someone might be able to do some sort of gene work and grow me trees with wheels on for such places instead of roots. It'd be much better, but no one can work out the bearings yet.
No. Has the integrity of the Tui Forest environment been retained on the university campus, do you think?
Well, yes and no. Forests are naturally changing anyway. But, you know, lowering all these buildings and all these people in must have an impact, really. We've endeavoured as far as possible to make it look natural, to salvage the rocks and the plants and reinstate them naturally. And I think myself and my crew have done as good a job as you can do. But just the impact of those big buildings... and the sprawling buildings especially. I mean, there's just less of it, and it gets to the point where if it gets too thin, it doesn't work. No, you just it. There's no plants. There's no birds. There's no support mechanisms. It goes critical if it gets too small, really.
Mm. Yes. Do you have problems with introduced species such as cats, feral or domestics, and dogs and foxes, etc.?
Dogs are the easiest because we round them up. They're nice and docile creatures, usually with one or two exceptions. And
do they come on?
Oh, yes. They follow students here, and some people think that they can keep dogs here, and some dogs generally get lost. And if they've got a collar with a name tag, they're returned to their owners. Otherwise, we only keep them for 24 hours and they have to go to the pound.
How often does this happen?
I suppose we'd round up a dog a month, or sometimes we might get two in a week.
Uh-huh.
Yes. But cats are we've caught quite a few cats in traps, but they're the worst things that we have. Cats and foxes.
Really? And you foxes. Have many cats?
Yes, there's usually two or three and a few around the village, yes. Yeah, they do a lot of damage to birds and reptiles.
Yes, and you as soon as you see a cat you catch it?
No, they're not that easy to catch. But no. Sure, we set when I say traps, I mean they're cage traps. They're not killing type traps.
No.
In fact, we've got one specially made that's got soft mesh on it so it doesn't damage them too much. Because, I mean, I'm a softie at heart.
Yes.
I don't believe in cruelty to people or animals.
No.
But if people realise just how many birds cats hunt, then it's a tragedy, really.
Mm. My cat attacks noisy miners who think they own my property.
Well, they do.
Yes, right. They didn't buy it, I did. She's killed, I suppose, four or five of them. But somebody told me the other day not to worry about the noisy miners because they kill native birds.
Yes, well, that's possibly true, but it just upsets me to have anything kill anything
else.
Yes,
I quite agree. I, when my cat does this, we don't speak for at least 24 hours.
Yes.
After I've roared at her and told her that she's a wicked animal.
Well, they're wired up that way. I mean, they're wired as killers, so they're not going to untrain them. But what you can do, of course, is make sure that it always wears at least one bell, possibly two.
Yes.
And that gives the birds a little bit of a chance, especially when they go hunting at night, because they fall on them out of the trees. That's how they do it at night. They climb trees and get the birds.
Oh, I see.
So the thing is not to put the cat out at night, but in fact to lock the cat in at night.
I see. And the foxes, you have...
Yes. Quite large ones that have even visited us down at the house and looks in at the glass doors.
Really?
On a Christmas day even in the heat of the summer, yes.
And what do you do when that happens?
I'm just taken back. No, I don't encourage them. But lizards we have. Oh. We used to feed the big lizards, but that was a bit of a disaster because I found that I always had to put the washing out because every time my wife went to hang out the washing, she'd get rushed by these big crocodiles wanting her to feed them. It was a bit disconcerting.
Yes.
So while we do feed the lizards, we make sure that they don't know that we feed them. So any scraps go out for them and they can scavenge them. But we make sure that they don't see us put them out.
I see. There is a lot of wildlife, actually, on the campus, isn't there?
Mm, mm.
Varieties of birds?
A lot. I actually see ladies. In fact, I was talking to a lady the other day. Lots of bird watchers actually come here specifically for that purpose.
Do they? Do they have to get permission to come onto the campus?
Not as far as I'm concerned. I encourage those sorts of people. That's part of the Griffith philosophy,
yes.
Is to come here. Provided the only thing they leave behind is footprints, everybody's welcome.
Mm.
And we are very much an island in suburbia. As more and more the states get cleared,
yes.
People that love birds come here, and birds that are looking for trees have to come here.
Mm, yes, that's so. And there are other things like, do you regard possums, for instance, as being vermin?
No.
No, neither do I. I think when they clump over my roof at night, I still think they're dear little things.
There wouldn't be any forest in Australia if it wasn't for possums.
Really? Why?
Well, because they control the mistletoe.
Oh.
And as soon as the possums get too thin on the ground and the trees get too thin to support them, if you go out further west towards Ipswich and places like that, the mistletoe is destroying an enormous amount of... Where I came from before, that was our biggest worry, was cutting mistletoe out of the trees.
Oh. Goodness, I didn't know
so
that.
So the possums keep that under control.
Hmm. Are guide dogs permitted on campus?
The principle is yes, but they have to be guide dogs, and this is a sore point with me just at the moment, because I don't believe a companion dog is a guide dog.
Now, what's the difference, then, between a companion dog and a guide dog?
Well, some people bring dogs along because they claim that the dog is a help to them, because they may be some way, you know, crippled or disadvantaged.
I see, but...
But a seeing-eyed dog is one thing, but a companion dog is another,
yes,
in my book.
Yes, I would
but
say
but there
so
is
too.
Some... There's a difficulty at the moment with this little... But I'm hoping it'll be resolved.
I see, yes. Now, did you have any special problems when Griffith was the athlete's village for the 1982 Commonwealth Games?
I felt actually that that was the beginning of lots of our difficulties.
Really?
Yes. Firstly, personally speaking, and this is totally selfish, and I'm not sure that it should go on record, but up until then, we had this site to ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
But after then we had a village where people lived, so then there are other people that lived on the site. So from 1973 till 1982, we were the only residents here, and it was serene and beautiful.
But didn't we have accommodation? When was the first accommodation for students?
Not until after the games. The games provided the accommodation for students.
Oh, I thought there were the...
Except Mount Gravatt, of course, but, you know, that was pre the amalgamation.
Yes. I thought these buildings up near the hub were established before the games because...
They were all for the games, including the hub itself. And that was the games village.
Mm. And then the extra buildings were built over on the northern area, which became CAD,
yes,
and
yes.
The offices.
We used to call that School Building 5 for a very interesting reason. I don't really know the history of that. Well, that was a very last-minute acquisition for the games.
Mm.
It was obvious that more space was needed, and the money came through very late. I received a phone call from the site and buildings manager on the Sunday night to say the money had been approved, and by 9 o'clock Monday morning... My crew had half-salvaged plants from the site. We moved in that early. We already had sprinklers running in anticipation so that we'd have wet ground to work from. So the foundations were being poured for that building before the designs for the top had even been drawn.
Goodness.
So it was literally a photo finish.
Mm.
Now, it was called School Building 5 because if it had been in any way connected as usable space for the village, there was a great risk at that particular time in politics that the builders might have gone on strike because they wanted a strike against the games village. So we called it School Buildings 5, secretly knowing that, sure, we weren't lying because it was going to be used for school buildings,
yes,
but essentially it was going to be extra accommodation for the games.
Yes.
And so... It just finished on time.
Yes,
we were still shovelling pine bark out while they were moving into the building.
Mm.
And that was the reason why it had external toilet blocks, which some of the games people weren't very impressed with, but it was never intended to be used for accommodation. But their problems really started then too, because up until that state, my understanding was that we were funded with the money that we had, with cash. But then we went into debt. That was when the university first had a debt, when it took on the village.
Hmm.
And that was a little bit to do with, I think, a personality that we had on council who was an ex-treasurer and was into debt financing. But that's just my observations. But I don't think we've ever quite recovered from being in debt. As you probably heard the other night, we were actually playing the short-term money market there,
yes,
at one stage, which equally I find offensive, but we were lucky. But that's another thing, isn't
it? Yes. And were there other problems that, in connection with... well, there was nobody... People weren't allowed on the site for 3 months.
Yes.
Did that affect you at all?
Oh, no, I'm... completely happy when there's nobody on site. speaking for the trees, that is.
Yes.
No, it was a highlight, actually, and there was quite a lot of thrill and excitement. And although I'm not into competitive sport, I must confess that I got caught up in the international atmosphere that it actually acquired, really. Mm. So it was good. It was fun. And it meant holidays had to be cancelled, but that turned out to be a bonus because I was able to accrue them and go on a really long overseas trip afterwards.
Oh, marvellous.
Yeah.
Good. Tell me, one of the subjects that always causes more discussion than anything else at council is car parks.
Yeah.
What is your opinion of the car parks? And do you resent this intrusion into the environment?
Oh, yes. It's with some relief that we finally went into building a multi-level car park. I have submitted many reports over the years about car parking, and everyone has referred to the necessity for multi-level car parks. These days, people consider their cars as their handbags, and they want them as close as possible to where they work. And high-rise car parking is the only way that we can ever achieve this. And Roger Johnson, in his early projections, showed how much of a problem surface car park was going to be in the long term.
Yes.
And I've actually used his figures and his drawings on many occasions to make that point. I am of the opinion that we should have had a charge for car parking much sooner than we did. Politically, we stalled too long and then got financially behind. And I think also there is still many solutions that are as yet untapped, not the least of which is one I've been talking about for a long time, namely bonded car parking. So if you want top quality car parking, protection from hail and security, well, you not only pay for it, but you put a deposit up front all the time that you use it. And when you leave the uni, you get that money back. Now, this may be between $1,000 and $5,000, who knows? But there are people who have lovely cars, and for that sort of money would be only too pleased to put it up front. They don't lose it, but that would pay off the interest on the borrowed capital necessary to do that. But I've touted this idea.
Still pay fees.
You still pay the fees.
Yes.
Yes. But you might get able to lock up one. You know, you might get a door on yours or something a bit better like that.
Yes.
But it's always there for you. It's got your name on it, and holidays or high days, that's yours, whether you use it or not. Hmm. I mean, this is another option, and I don't think there is one single solution to car parking.
No.
But there must be several. And the other is if you, like the council with their special lanes that they're developing now, if the car's got so many people in it, then you can go into a certain park and you're okay. And that's already started to happen.
Hmm.
But I think we've been a little bit slow to be that innovative. I would like to have thought that Griffith University, being a university, would have been the cutting edge of some of these solutions, but we've been a little bit me-tourers, I think.
Mm.
There's no doubt about it. The cars will be the death of mankind and this campus if we don't sort it out.
Yes, there's such a thing as car pollution, isn't there?
Yes, and I think every building should have sufficient car parking underneath it to nearly support the occupants. Well, we've just carried on as if each building only has a single purpose.
Mm.
So I believe we could have car parking underneath, we could have sports on the roofs, we could have childcare inside some of the buildings up in the academic core, so mothers would be having close contact throughout the day with especially the younger children, rather than virtually have to pack a lunch to go right down to the bottom of the hill and discover whether they still have any children or not. So it hasn't been quite as integrated as sociologists would have had it. We've had only special purposes. And I guess that's been based on if there's money for that or that's the way it goes.
That's the problem, yes.
Yes, but it's been unwise and as I say, it's been just copycats of other people's mistakes.
Mm. Yes. Would you like to see cars banned altogether from the campus?
Well, that would put me in a dilemma too.
Yes.
No. Well, of course, there's two answers to that. Roger Johnson attempted a mid-course, and that was to have no cars inside the academic core. And that has partly worked, but we haven't actually had a good enough service roads in the academic core. We've got dead-end streets.
Mm.
We needed better flow-through for servicing the buildings.
Mm.
But by essentially, yes, keeping them out. Anyone that's been to some of the car-free cities in Europe, especially the medieval ones, I mean, it's just magnificent not to have the noise and the pollution.
Yes.
So we have done that a little bit.
Mm.
But your cars are, at the moment, still a fact of life.
Mm.
But I'm hopeful one day that we might have a monorail raging from the city and coming right through campus and connecting up with Garden City and railheads. And I've suggested that in various writings, but, you know, maybe I live in the dreamy future, I don't know.
2001, maybe.
Maybe.
Actually, no, they do pretty well with that City Express bus.
It's good. I use it myself 15
minutes from the city centre to the underground car park, the city's Meyer Centre, to Griffith. In fact, they were just one day recently, it was about 13 minutes.
Yes, I use it myself. Even though I have a car, I will often, if it's single-purpose work in the city, I'll catch the bus.
Yes. Just cuts out the worry about parking in the city, doesn't
That's
it?
That's right.
Who are the people in any sphere who impressed you most in your years at Griffith, in any sphere of the university?
Well, I think Alan Cole, but that's basically because I see him as a practical person and a very helpful person. And that's probably because he's such a contrast of bosses that I've had in the past. And because also I've had a lot of an association with him, but I haven't had a lot of association with academic people.
No, right.
And I've been a little disappointed with that. I really did think when I came to the uni that I would have a lot more in common with them. Because essentially, although I don't have an academic background, I'm very interested in science, philosophy, music, exobiology, a host of other things. But I've found had very little contact with people whose those are their major interests.
I've seen you at various functions and things there. You've been to, you know, you go to a lot of things, don't you?
Yes.
Associated with the university.
Yes.
And you always enjoy them.
Yes. I enjoy good stimulating conversation.
Yes.
In fact, I've always found small talk extremely difficult.
Yes. Yes, I can understand that. Nobody in the academic field?
Oh, okay. I can't think of his name. The fellow who was set up the School of Business Administration.
Professor Limerick, David Limerick.
David Limerick, yes. I heard a lecture given by him once and I was very impressed. I liked what he said, which really reflected the Griffith philosophy. And I've said as much to his face that he's one of my favourite academics.
Hmm.
But I'm sure, I mean, there's people like Colin the Carrots. I mean, I had quite a lot of contact with his son, but I've never actually had a sit-down talk.
With Colin?
Yes, I suspect that some of these people don't know where I'm at. They think because I'm not from an academic background that I don't have a particular interest.
Oh, I don't think so. I don't think that's the Griffith idea at all.
It isn't, no. But sometimes maybe people suspect that. I don't know. And I think also that people think because you're into plants, you're only into plants.
Mm.
But I'm not. I'm interested in a lot of other things.
Yes. Really. Oh, that's great.
Mm. Yes. Oh, life's very exciting, I always find.
Yes, I think it is too. Have you any... Well, what do you regard as your greatest achievements on the campus?
Well, perhaps still being here after being outspoken on occasions.
Well, when you've been outspoken, what do you what's the response been? Have you know you've had arguments or amiable arguments?
Oh well, there was a few things I've stood firm on as much as I could, and I've lost some and won some. Yes.
Well, that's just far.
Yes, they wanted to put to put the sewerage line right across the side of the hill for the games village, and I said, look, I just told him you're not going to do it. I said you're going to put it on top of the ground. Gulp, and they did. And that, in fact, has become policy now. That if there's no projected future development, then big services like that, especially sewerage ones, run across the ground, rather than put a dozer through everything and excavate it,
yes,
and
yes.
just cause absolute horrendous destruction.
Yes.
They run across the surface. But it hadn't been done until I told them I had to do it that way. I don't know why I was so cheeky. Maybe I was angry.
Yes. Well, you feel strongly about
exactly,
it, obviously.
Exactly. Mm. But then again, the destruction of the big rock outcrop at the village, I was unsuccessful on that one. And the building was put over the top of it, and it should have actually, I believe, been used as the main feature, and the hub should have looked in on that. It's a wonderful $1 million worth of landscaping. Anyway, I salvaged a few of the rocks, one of which weighed 35 tons, and repositioned it along the ring road, and I suppose most people think it's always lived there. But it was a remnant, actually, of a beautiful outcrop that I felt should have stayed. But I guess for only people like me that have the job of utilising these materials can appreciate their true value.
Yes. Well, yeah, obviously, there are two of your achievements which are, you know, more important than the fact that you've remained here all this time, succeeded in remaining. What are the others? What other achievements?
I feel that the landscape team is...
How big is the team, incidentally?
It's about 19, I think, at the moment.
19.
With a hard core of probably about 12.
And are the women on the...
Oh, yes, yes. I've employed women gardeners right from the beginning. We've employed people from all sorts of training colleges, unemployed people, people with... we've got a mentally retarded lady working for us at the moment. We have all sorts of people come and train as part of our landscape team.
Oh, great.
I was the first division section in the uni to pioneer split shifts. You know, we had one job shared by two people. So I personally feel that if God had other plans for me tomorrow, that there's a sufficient base for everyone to run on without me.
Well, that in itself is a great achievement.
Well, I hope so.
But tell me some more about the work, because, you know, these individual things that you've been doing, I think that's interesting.
Well, I really don't think that any landscape is complete without water.
Mm-hmm.
And so pools, and I think we now have about 13 to 15 small pools around the place. Some of them are not very obvious, but they're, you know, little surprises as people can come on.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them perhaps look like brown, miserable billabongs, but they don't look like blue lakes from Central Europe.
Yeah, well, you can't really expect it.
Exactly. And it's all part of the scene.
Yeah,
and I've actually pioneered a structural technique for building ponds. I've put it on video and I've described it in lots of gardening lectures, and I think it's going to be a standard procedure for people building ponds.
Really?
It's only a minor thing of interest to people who like concrete and building ponds. But anyway, we've pioneered that very successfully.
Oh.
And if I can sing praises and you're asking me to do that, if the roofs at Griffith University were as secure as the ponds that we built, then we wouldn't have many leaks.
Oh, well, that's great.
Yeah, so, you know, I enjoyed that. And, of course, I did enjoy the company of the vice, the Chancellor's wife. What was her name?
Mrs. Jean.
No, the Chancellor's wife.
Oh, the Chancellor's wife. Lady Bray.
Lady Bray.
Rosalie Bray.
Right, yeah. She invited me to give a lecture to one of her gardening clubs. That was yonks ago. And that was the thin end of the wedge, because I virtually gave at least one lecture to, I would believe, every gardening club in Brisbane.
Really?
And some outside of Brisbane. And in those days, it was very important to promote Griffith.
Yes, and that was a wonderful way of doing it.
It was. And because people didn't even know where Griffith was. I mean, you'd ring up in the early days for materials, and they'd think you were ringing trunk line from New South Wales.
Yes, where the drugs are.
Yes, and in fact, an interesting story was that one of the first parties we had when University House opened... it was scheduled to start at 3 o'clock, and the small staff gathered, but the beer hadn't arrived. And by 5 o'clock, it hadn't arrived, and they rang up the local pub and said, you know, where's the beer? And they said, but we dispatched it ages ago. But of course, it went to Queensland University. It didn't come here. So we were that unknown, even locally, in the early days. So that was all part of the promotion. But with the amalgamations, I've told all people who want talks from me that they only get them after hours. I don't do any daytime lectures anymore, but I've done hundreds over the years since I've been here on many topics, not just gardening. But the gardening was the main one, really. Mm.
Lady Bray was a wonderful woman, wasn't she?
Yes. She just integrated herself as if she was being paid to be here, really.
Yes.
And I think of those people as in the same way as history records the first... what was he? His name was Bailey. He was the first botanist in Queensland.
Oh, yes.
Right. Now, Bailey was the botanist for the Queensland government, and when he retired, he carried on exactly the same, except that he didn't get paid. That's the sort of level of the dedication that I think Griffith started off with.
I think it still has.
There's a lot of it there. Yes. Oh, yes.
I think that in many ways it has.
A lot of it's still there.
You know, you've got this wonderful woman who did counselling and assisting students in the science faculty.
Mm. Yes.
Flo.
Yes.
Marvellous woman.
Yes.
And that there are people like Flo in all the faculties, I'm sure.
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, the community at large has an enormous amount of voluntary work, and it's incredible.
Yes.
Just one organisation I work for, I'm involved in as a volunteer, just in 1 year that I can remember, it did 9,000 man hours of work in the community.
Mm.
So, yeah, there's a lot of that does actually happen. Mm. But it was very obvious in those days because there were more percentage people like that, whereas now there's lots of ordinary me too as hard workers at that, but they've watered down the percentage.
Yes, that's so. And the overall picture is bigger anyway.
Yes.
And it's not quite so easy to see the outstanding ones.
Yes. And of course, when an organisation gets that big, people feel that they're a tooth in a cog in a wheel.
Mm.
Whereas in those days, you felt you were part of the mainspring.
Mm. I remember hearing people who'd come when I was here in the early days, I mean, in my early days, and 1976, 77, 78, students who'd been at the University of Queensland saying, "Oh, they," and came here saying, "Oh, they loved it at Griffith because at University of Queensland they felt they were just a cog in a, a little cog in a wheel, but here they were individuals."
Mm, yes, and unfortunately, I think the amalgamation has made it a bigger machine. You know, I would have liked to have thought that we would have maintained those bits of individuality. In fact, I would have thought that the purpose of education was, in fact, to maintain greater amounts of individuality rather than a sameness. But we didn't initiate that policy, did we?
No. One of the things, of course, Griffith has always, I don't know whether you've been involved in these, has always had, and I remember Sir Theodore talking about the need for reducing them, we've always had large numbers of committees, and everybody's had to be represented on a committee. Have you had a lot of committee work?
Yeah, especially in the early days, yes. And in fact, I was going to run a competition once to see if I could find someone that wasn't on a committee. But provided that they are working committees, I think they're a good idea. As soon as they outlive their usefulness, surely they must be terminated.
Yes.
They shouldn't meet just for the sake of it.
No.
But I think that was a way to maintain some democracy, and that's necessary.
Do you think Griffith has been a participatory democracy?
I think so, especially in the early days, yes. Mm. And I think, and that was something that perhaps I didn't understand fully until it was explained to me by Professor Limerick, that in fact the interfaces of these various facets of the university where there was problems which necessitated discussion and bordering on argument is in fact maintaining a constant update and guaranteeing that we're not redundant.
Yes, yes. You progress through it.
Yes, but to have a pyramid structure and everyone not wanting to upset the person at the top of the pyramid means you can become redundant and not know it.
Yes. I don't think we've reached that stage, and I don't think I hope we never will.
No.
Now, have you any favourite spots on the campus?
Oh, yes. Usually, where there aren't many people, mm-hmm. there's still a few rocky outcrops over on the western edge.
Mm-hmm.
And just after rain, when the grass trees are in flower and the bottle brushes are in flower, yes, it's just to sit down amongst the twigs on a nice rock. There's still some nice places, yes. Yeah. But quiet and shady.
Quiet places like the Dunn Memorial.
Yes,
quiet place.
Yeah, those sorts of places down near the stream and the yes. river and the creek. Yeah.
Do students use them much, do you think?
No.
I think that's understandable, don't you,
yes.
really? Because, you know, students, it's a pity, but students these days have got to devote so much time to their studies that they don't have the time to stand and stare or sit and stare.
No.
And think.
And we had a, digressing a little, but one of the greatest visitors that ever came here was a landscape architect from China, and he gave a lecture here.
Oh, yes.
And he was a beautiful man, and the first thing he said is that I'm a poet. And the second thing he said, I'm an artist. And thirdly, I'm a landscape architect. Well, I felt a few sort of chuckles in the audience, but, you know, he went on, and he eventually demonstrated completely how great he was. He did projects on an enormous scale involving thousands of people and hundreds of acres, projects in China.
In China.
Yes, and his paintings and work, eventually when he showed us his slides, I mean, you could only just look in awe. And we asked him what he thought about Australian landscapes, and he was exceedingly polite. And he didn't say anything nasty at all, but what he did say was that he had noticed that in Australia, that if we positioned a seat at an outcrop or an outlook somewhere, we invariably had the pathway running in front of the seat. But in China, you would always have the seat looking at the view and the pathway running behind you, because you didn't want to see the people. And that is a big difference between people who live in China, where there's teeming millions, and people who live in Australia. In Australia, you want to sit where you can be seen. Looking at the scenery is only part of it. And if you look at the philosophy between successful restaurants with their glass fronts and places like that where you can be seen,
yeah.
Australians enjoy one another's company.
Yeah.
And the Dunn Memorial is too lonely.
Now, what about the future? How would you like to see the campus develop?
I'd like it actually almost to stop at this point.
Not to get any bigger?
No. I'd like to just consolidate at this point and perhaps a little bit more development of Mount Gravatt. I think like any artist, you have to know when to say stop, otherwise you end up messing up the painting. It's having just the right amount of paint in the right place on the canvas. And I think we're rushing ahead to create a clever Australia, but I don't think we're thinking about a wise Australia. And I think the students will need to be able to immerse themselves in beautiful landscapes as it comes out in their personality and their feel. And I think that's what's in everybody. If you in a bird's egg, in the egg of a migrating bird, is a chart of the stars. It's handed down in its genes.
Mm-hmm.
And if we spend time in a natural environment, it becomes part of our genes. And then we know where we're going, otherwise we lose our way. And if we just live in torturous cities and cityscapes, that will become how we think we should be, as witnesses what's happening in some of the places in the world where you and I never want to visit.
Mm.
Because those people haven't had access
no.
to those views and those scenes. I mean, I know that I was surprised when I went back to England to find how English I was. You know, the bluebells and the English birds
yes,
and the smells,
yes.
they're locked into my genes.
Yes.
I can't get rid of them.
No.
And I think that's necessary for us all. We have to see that when we're children.
Mm.
It mightn't be important to us,
mm.
but that's the main teaching aid here, is to get that serenity and appreciating in people.
Mm.
You know, the bottom line, you know, mathematics amount to nothing if it's just going to be a quicker way of destroying the planet.
No. Do you think that the environmental sciences, used to be called Australian Environmental Studies Faculty, school, do you think that's had a great impact on the students at Griffith and on the staff?
Yes and no, but then again, not quite as much as I would have hoped for. Mm. But I'm an idealist and difficult to please.
Yes. Mm. Well, I think that's covered that very nicely.
I'm sure we've run out of tape.
No, I don't think so, but I think we've covered the subject adequately, and I'm most grateful to you for your time, Colin. Thank you very much indeed.
Lovely meeting you.
Great.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Now, there's nothing else we have to do, is there? No, that's the lot. You don't want to hear the tape, do you?